You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the hottest time of the year for one of Southern California's local treasures, Joshua Tree National Park. But 100 years ago, not many people thought the Mojave Desert was anything special. So how did it become a protected and valued space? Well, it's all due to a woman from Pasadena, a woman you might not have heard of. Most people haven't, actually.
I'm with KCRW in Santa Monica. I'm doing a story on Minerva Hamilton Hoyt. I'm wondering, have you ever heard of her?
No, I haven't.
Hey there. Hi. I'm with KCRW in Santa Monica. I'm doing a story on Minerva Hamilton Hoyt. Wondering if you guys have ever heard of her.
No.
Guten Tag. Kennen Sie Minerva Hamilton Hoyt? Die Dame an der Mauer?
Nein.
KCRW's Juliana Mayo trying her darndest out at Joshua Tree National Park to find folks, even folks from Germany, who had heard of Minerva Hamilton Hoyt. Well, you can't really blame them when even out at the park, the only references to the woman who conjured this place into being are a plaque and a mural on the side of the former visitor center. But you really should know about her because she's got a great story, and we're celebrating that today on this anniversary of Joshua Tree becoming protected land. We're devoting the whole show for that honor to the struggle to protect the beauty, the weirdness, and the wonder that is the high desert of Joshua Tree. And Juliana's here in the studio to talk about it. Hey, Juliana.
Hi, Steve.
You didn't find anyone who knew her?
I mean, I found one lady who did, but only because she had read like a sign at the visitor center the day before.
That's what it was. She saw the sign on the plaque and she was like, oh, I recognize that name. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So who was Minerva Hamilton Hoyt?
Oh, my goodness. I want to shout her name from the rooftops. She was this feisty Southern lady who got things done at a time when that just wasn't really a thing, which is totally why she spoke to me. I did find someone who knows a lot about her, Joe Zarkey, a retired Joshua Tree ranger.
Every park's got a story of how I got started. And so I was interested in what's Joshua Tree's story.
All right, I'll bite. What's the story?
Well, it all starts in Mississippi, where Minerva was born in 1866. She grew up on a cotton plantation, so she's coming up in a lot of privilege. Her dad fought in the Civil War for the Confederacy. Then he becomes a state senator. She gets sent off to finishing school to learn all the things fancy ladies were expected to know back then. And then after finishing school, she gets married to a doctor, another thing fancy ladies were supposed to do back then. And his name was Sherman Hoyt. They moved to Pasadena in the late 1890s and settled into 5 acres of beautiful land in South Pasadena in the Hoyt Mansion. But all was not joy and tea parties for her. Here's Joe Zarkey again.
She had a son, Charles. He died tragically as an infant. Her husband died in 1898, so she was widowed. So she got active in a lot of civic causes and things. She did a Red Cross drive in World War I that 22,000 people showed up for. So she had a talent for taking on big projects, apparently talent for organizing things, and just had a lot going for her.
She's president of the Boys and Girls Club. She's the L.A. Symphony Orchestra president. She's in the Valley Hunt Club, which I guess is the predecessor to the Tournament of Roses Parade. She is just a hardcore leader in the community. And then another fancy lady interest that she had was gardening. Steve, she actually stocked this pond on her 5 acres with alligators that she imported from her native Mississippi.
Oh, my goodness.
And had these lavish garden parties. And then around the 1920s, as part of all this gardening, she fell in love with California's native plants after making some trips out to the desert. And at this point, she's in her 60s. Here's Joe again.
And now, at this stage of her life, she decides, I'm going to spend my years working on desert conservation. And boy, did she.
Minerva really found solace and peace in the desert after all of this loss, not just beauty. Here is my neighbor and friend, author Janet Fitch, reading some of Minerva's desert writings.
During nights in the open, lying in a snug sleeping bag, I soon learned the charm of a Joshua forest. The desert possessed me, and I constantly wished that I might find some way to preserve its natural beauty.
It sounds, Juliana, like she really fell for the place back then and then turned it into a cause? Right? That, I mean, she was into causes, right? She was into things.
All
she
the
wanted
causes.
The scouts and the orchestra and all that stuff. So, I mean, how does she spring into action then?
The desert becomes her number one cause, and she goes all in on educating people, especially on the East Coast, because that's where all of the decisions are being made about what land we're going to preserve. That's kind of the seed of power. And she creates exhibits of desert landscapes and literally moves the earth to show people what the desert looks like so they will better understand why it's important to preserve it. And we're talking like super involved displays. Like think about the Natural History Museum, you know, with like the painted backdrops and taxidermied animals and cacti and just all kinds of cool stuff.
And this is a woman doing it, right?
Yes.
100 years ago.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And she's spending her fortune putting all of this stuff on rail cars and shipping it across the country. At one point, she sends stuff not across the country, but across the Atlantic to Kew Gardens in London to drum up support over there. Here's how she described what she was up to in a woman's magazine at the time.
In early days, when this region received its name, people came into the valley in ox carts or on horses or mules. And naturally, to many of them, it proved fatal because exit was well nigh impossible. They found death. I found life. They saw crucifixion. I saw the resurrection. And in my Death Valley exhibit in London, I tried to portray the dawn.
So, Steve, it's just important to remember her dad was a politician, right? So she's learned all this stuff from him about lobbying and raising awareness. And then she's bringing her Southern hospitality to all these women's garden shows. And that's kind of like how this whole thing is coming together.
I feel like there's a but coming, though. I feel like there's a twist to the story.
Well, yeah, she's a woman in her 60s trying to get people to listen to her. That's hard today, let alone in the 20s. And also, she's trying to get people to listen, but they just see the desert as a wasteland.
And so when does America finally get on board here?
Well, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt gets into office in 1932, suddenly he's all about conserving land, and she's got her chance. She heads to D.C. to meet with him, and he sends some dudes to come to the desert and take a look. Doesn't go great.
It doesn't go great.
No.
What happened?
They're not from California. They don't understand what's going on, and they just think this lady's crazy. But then she just keeps pushing. So 3 years later in 1935, finally, Roosevelt sends someone from California who does understand the landscape. And he says, yes, this land needs to be protected. A year later, 1936, we've got Joshua Tree National Monument.
Joshua Tree National Monument. But it's Joshua Tree National Park, right? When did that happen?
That doesn't happen until 1994, which is the year before our friendly park ranger, Joe Zarkey, got posted there.
I mean, it's still pretty vulnerable there, right? Even with federal protections.
Right.
I mean, and the York Fire, right? Now, that's not in the national park, but it certainly is nearby.
Luckily, the York Fire is about 80% contained now and not threatening Joshua Tree. But climate change is coming for Joshua Trees. On a positive note, visitors are coming to the park in record numbers. Over 3 million came last year, and that's all kind of thanks to Minerva.
KCRW's Juliana Mayo with the word about Minerva Hamilton Hoyt. Juliana, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Let's focus on that 3 million number that Juliana just mentioned. 3 million people who come to Joshua Tree Park every year, the national park. And if or when you go, you need a place to stay. That's where the thousands of vacation rentals in the area come in. But with all that influx comes changes to the Joshua Tree community, both good and bad. Marilee Cushon is a longtime resident, and she owns the Roadrunner Grab and Go. That's a deli in the town of Joshua Tree. Marilee, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And JoJo Swivin is a realtor who owns a vacation rental out in the Joshua Tree area. JoJo, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Marilee, how would you say this influx has changed the town over the years? Have you watched it grow like this?
Oh, yeah. I first started coming out to Joshua Tree in 2004 when it was very quiet little town. You know, tourism has definitely gone up, which is great for the town. It means people can have jobs here. The infrastructure has not matched.
Well, delve into that. What do you mean by that, the infrastructure? You're talking about roads and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we struggle with things like tourists coming into town and local business owners are putting up their own porta potties just randomly in downtown, paying for them so that people don't pee behind their businesses. I feel like the TOT, the transient occupancy tax revenue that's collected by Airbnbs, goes back to our county, but it doesn't go back to our town.
The county is what? San Bernardino County,
San Bernardino County, which is a huge county. So they get to do what they want with that money, and it doesn't feel like it's helping our issues in any way. We wind up having these weekends where just hordes descend on our town. Coming up this weekend with a meteor shower, every Airbnb that I know of is booked.
This is the Perseid meteor shower, right?
Yep, and it's a new moon, so everybody's very excited about the dark skies. You know, it's all focused on one weekend. So everybody's making a bunch of money right now, and then the rest of the month is just nothing.
You mentioned that the infrastructure hasn't quite caught up, but the prices to rent and to buy something out there has, right?
There not only are no affordable rents, but there literally have not been long-term rentals available. More often than not, someone renting a long-term rental has been getting evicted by their landlord in favor of creating a short-term rental. Right now, what's happening is they're oversaturated. So there have been a lot of former Airbnbs up for sale. There have been a lot that are becoming long-term rentals. But in order to make the mortgages, they have to charge, you know, $2,500 to $5,000 a month for a long-term rental here. You know, our town has a, I believe, 23.5% poverty rate. They don't have $5,000 a month.
Yeah. I mean, this, you can, by the way, you can carbon copy that pretty much anywhere in California, right? But you've got the added joy, I guess, and I say that sarcastically, of being a vacation town, too, a place where people want to go to sort of escape. Jojo, I know you visit out there a lot. Have you seen the place change as a result of so many folks coming out there?
What drew me to the area was the architecture and design and live music. And these things have really boomed in the last few years, along with the STRs.
Short-term rentals, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a small business owner out there. I can't speak to finding my employees a place to live. And I know I'm in Yucca, and most of my friends are in Yucca. So our transient occupancy tax is paid to the city and not the county. But they don't disclose to us where they spend the TOT.
That's transient occupancy tax.
Yeah, and I actually recently sent a request in, because it is public record, and it is something we should know.
Well, you work in real estate, though, right?
I do.
I mean, if you had to sort of, you know, wage a guess of what percentage of the properties you've been involved with out in Joshua Tree, would you say have been purchased just to be short-term rentals?
I would say over half.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's a retirement town. It always has been, as far as I've known, and I've been going since the 90s.
Well, you've had to have seen a lot of changes there, right? A lot of changes in Joshua Tree, people going out there. But yeah, you also have to live. And if it's a retirement town, you're on limited income, right?
Right. But I mean, people buy houses out there to retire. It's not a place you would go rent a house to retire. They go out to buy houses because they're cheaper than most of California.
Yeah. Merrill Lee, as you mentioned, Joshua Tree is actually in unincorporated San Bernardino County. What's the county doing? I mean, this isn't a city, right?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're saying the money isn't going. I mean, where's the money going? San Bernardino's a big county for sure. But is anyone showing up at a, you know, at a supervisor's meeting or whatever, saying,
oh,
hey,
consistently,
look, really?
Monthly. I mean, we have a little video screen where we get to talk to our county. We have a relatively local rep out here. The people that I associate with are social activists. We are community minded. We are part of this town. We have been here. We want to continue to be here. Some of us have grown up here. It's always been a struggle to feel like our voices are being heard. Honestly, whether it's in Yucca or whether it's in the county.
There are a few folks who've started a group, and I understand it's called Go Back to LA. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know that I'd call that a few folks who started a group. I feel like that is people who grew up here and feel like their town is now something they don't recognize. They're frustrated by an influx of people who have money. You know, they're not bringing anything to this town. They're just taking from this town. I am not part of Go Back to LA. I think everybody should come out to the desert and love it. I mean, it is a stunningly beautiful place. It is an ecosystem that needs to be preserved. But seeing it responsibly and understanding the stewardship of land. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating when you can't go to lunch in your own town. There's not many options in our town. And part of that is county code and, you know, county makes it difficult. And part of it is finding staff and employees to run your business. I mean, there's a business that's been in downtown, the longest running business in Joshua Tree, has struggled to be open nights because it's just so hard to find enough people because people keep having to move away. it's tough.
I want to thank you both for coming on and talking with us. By the way, San Bernardino County is holding public meetings this month to study the effects of vacation rentals throughout the county. So for the Joshua Tree region, there's one coming up later this month, August 24th, from 4:30 to 6. We'll have more information, by the way, at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Marilee Couchon, owner of Roadrunner Grab and Go, JoJo Swiven from Post and Beam Real Estate. Thanks to you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis as we continue our exploration of the history and the mysteries of Joshua Tree. Now picture this. You're driving through the desert late at night. It's dark, but a dry heat still lingers in the air. It's not a real town for miles. And suddenly, your radio signal cuts out. You fidget with the dial for a moment, and then you land on this.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. It's the time of the year when the heat cooks your brain. Nobody should ever have to make a serious decision when it's over 100 degrees. Nobody should be required to think at all. It's just too hot.
Indeed, just too hot. Well, for 8 years, Ken Lane of Desert Oracle has been keeping the Desert Wanderer company with his esoteric musings about the lore, the legends, and the landscape of the Mojave by way of both his cult favorite radio show and a magazine of the same name. Lane joins us now to talk about the Desert Oracle's strange beginnings and to share some of his favorite Joshua Tree stories, too. Hi, Ken.
Hello, hello.
Before we get into the Joshua Tree lore, I do want to dig into some Desert Oracle lore. You worked in the news industry, right, before starting this program. Why'd you make the switch to writing a magazine and hosting a show about urban legends and UFOs and other oddities?
Well, I've always been interested in this type of subject, and during the years I spent as a newspaper reporter and in radio and et cetera, I was always attracted to these assignments. When I started looking at what to do with the remaining useful years that I have, which is something we should all consider fairly often, I thought, well, I already live in the desert. I love the desert. Let's just make everything about the desert.
What is it about the desert, do you think, that sort of draws that out? Is it how isolated it is? Is it because there are fewer people there? I mean, what is it about being so far inland in that place of isolation?
It's all of those things. And the desert wilderness has always attracted people who need space for various reasons. Maybe they're an artist like Georgia O'Keeffe. Maybe they're a messiah like Jesus. You know, there are all these people who end up playing outsized roles in history and culture who are drawn to the weird landscape where nature is kind of right in your face. It's a good place to find out what you're made of.
You've also told tales of supernatural happenings in the desert. What are a few of the most memorable for you?
There's a long association with flying saucers and UFOs. The flying saucer era started in 1947, and a lot of the key proponents of it were Los Angeles area writers who would make intentional trips out to the desert where they thought it was more likely they would see the space visitors. The older stories that had been going around the tribes for centuries are about variations of a Sasquatch sort of monster. In the Palm Springs area is called Tockwitz, and there's Tockwitz Canyon, named after this sort of shaggy 8-foot monster with glowing eyes that was some sort of psychic avenger. Where I am, and around the north side of Joshua Tree National Park, our variation is called Yucca Man.
You want to read your story about Yucca Man? This is from Volume 1 of your Desert Oracle.
Sure, I'll read the opening part of that, which is about this area, about the Marine base out of 29 Palms. The story you'll hear most often goes like this. There's a young Marine on guard duty in some far-off corner of the massive 29 Palms Desert Training Base. He hears an awful sound in the dark, something like a growl. Then the breathing. Coming from one side of his lonesome little guard booth and now from the other. It is circling him. He steps out into the dark, his sidearm drawn, and there it stands, 8 feet tall, an unbearable stench, the eyes glowing like red coals. Sometimes, the story has the Marine being knocked down unconscious by the shaggy-haired beast and found hours later by the next shift. Since the 1970s, when the Mojave Desert base expanded from a primitive World War II encampment, there have been regular reports of new recruits terrorized by both the Yucca Man and pranksters inspired by the tales.
Where do you get your inspiration? Was there something that you listened to early on in life that said, I want to do this. I want to tell more of the off-the-cuff stories. Is it the Joe Franks of the world?
Well, Joe Frank was fantastic. I remember listening to Joe Frank on your station in the late 1990s when I lived in the area. Joe Frank's stories were fiction. I always thought the best weird tales were true. So I wanted to take down the oral traditions, the kind of local lore that inspires people to make bumper stickers and t-shirts. One of the things I listened to as a kid was Art Bell broadcasting out of Pahrump, Nevada, his own radio station.
Coast to coast, man.
That's
coast
right.
Coast to coast, yeah.
Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM. From January 18th, 2002.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, as the case may be, and whatever time.
What kind of energy do you think contributes to that in the desert? I mean, do you think it's the perfect place for it?
It is, because it has so much space. And the reason why it has so much space is not an accident. When all of that territory was added to the United States, what the government decided to do was to keep the desert land as public land parcels. So we still have this, a 2-hour drive from the second biggest metropolitan area in America, which is just fantastic. There's not a lot of places where you can hop in the car in 2 hours, be in a place where there are no other people in the square mile you're in.
Well, you broadcast to a lot of it, and we thank you for coming on, Ken Lane, host of Desert Oracle Radio, which broadcasts from Joshua Tree every Friday night, by the way, at 10 o'clock on the radio station Z107.7. You can also find a link to stream the show or subscribe to the magazine of the same name, and all that's at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Ken Lane, thanks for coming on and talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this evening. Tomorrow in this slot, Kim Masters hosts The Business and the Politics of Local TV. Hope you can join us at 1 and 6 for The Business tomorrow. Visit us online anytime at Greater LA, kcrw.com/GLA, or on KCRW's iPhone or Android app, and tell us how you're doing. While you're there, grab the podcast, too, to have with you on the go. You can also get the podcast anywhere you get your podcasts at kcrw.com/GLA, or again, check out the app on Android or iPhone. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all helped with the show this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ear. Have a great night.